Hello, and welcome to yet another episode of What the Kids Were Watching, the podcast about the weird, wonderful, and terrible babysitter movies of our youth. My name is Sada, and my co-host, as always, is Raphael. How are you today, Raph?
I'm doing great. Glad to join you on the couch.
Feeling speedy today?
Yes, I am.
That's the spirit. So, this podcast, as you know, is dedicated to movies that Raph and I watched on repeat when we were younger. The movie we're talking about today is a film that came out when I was in high school and Raph was in college, having just finished your freshman year, right? Or just about to go to college?
Just about to go to college.
Okay, my bad. This movie came out when both of us were in high school, and yet it is a film that we watched a lot, and I don't think it's an understatement to say that it had a lot of impact on both of us. What was really fun about revisiting this movie today, and I got to admit, ultimately, I came away from this rewatching with a really big appreciation for this movie, as dumb and ridiculous as it is. I mean, I just got to admit, I'm going to get it out of the way. There's no point in talking about the movie we're going to talk about and saying, I don't think that's possible. This entire movie is an impossibility, one impossibility after another. It's like, what is it, that Alice in Wonderland quote about you must believe in 10 impossible things before breakfast. I'll verify it. I'll make a note on this podcast. And
well, this movie would be 10 impossible things before lunch, since it all takes place in the morning.
In the first 20 minutes, all of this is impossible, and we love it. We're here today for the 1994 Jan de Bont movie, Speed.
Now,
also known, according to Homer Simpson, as I think it was called The Bus That Couldn't Slow Down. Speed continues to influence our culture more than 20 years after it was made.
We can talk about the making of this movie, how it came together, but I think what's important first to say is, for us as an audience back then, what this movie really meant. Because by 1994, we were sort of tired of Die Hard clones. We had had Yeah, we were. Because by this point, we had had Die Hard 2, we had had Under Siege, we had had Passenger 57, we had Cliffhanger. We were still watching them, but there was this sort of, ugh, it's that thing again.
Well, I think that using the word clone is not accurate, because a clone would be the same. These were poor imitations. They seemed initially like the same thing, and then you get a little bit closer, and they were missing the main character's charisma, or the villain's charisma, or, I don't know, any number of the great things that made Die Hard so unique and wonderful. But I get where you're going.
Because I remember, 2 years before this movie, I was in the auditorium and I got to see back-to-back the trailers to Under Siege and Passenger 57. And both trailers had the line, but there's one thing they didn't count on. And the audience cracked up both times because they already knew the Die Hard on a blank, which is pretty much what people would refer to it in the media.
Yeah.
So to hear that Keanu Reeves, who up to this point was still, he hadn't found his ground in the industry. He had, you know, everyone loved him as Bill and Ted, but that's what they thought of him as. They made fun of him in Point
Well,
Break.
Technically, they loved him in Bill and Ted. He played Ted. Sorry. He didn't play Bill and Ted. Love you.
But the point is, most people don't even know which one he played. And that's...
Oh, I don't want to believe that. That's just sad. Y'all have seen that movie, right? Okay, well, we'll talk about Bill and Ted in another episode.
Very much so.
Ross right. Back then, Keanu Reeves, bless his heart, was sort of just seen as a Ted-like character. He was seen as this guy, sort of a surfer, dude kind of guy. That's what he's going to play. And he got typecast a lot, which is not really fair, because as we've seen in films like John Wick,
Matrix movies.
The Matrix movies, thank you.
but this was like 5 years before even The Matrix. And so what's very key about this movie is, I remember I went to see this movie at a sneak screening. It was for free, so it's why I went and go see it. The word, I say with finger quotes because there was no real internet people were on at that point, was that this might be a sleeper hit, which is what made me go see it, even though it was a first-time director and a lead actress I'd never heard of. And there was like nothing that I could hold on to say, well, it's directed by the cinematographer of Die Hard.
It just sort of comes out of nowhere, like a bus rounding the corner.
And it wasn't even an expensive movie. It was $30 million. And to give you comparison, that was less than half of most Die Hard clones out there.
Dang.
with bigger casts and bigger actors.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to say, this movie experience with my old high school buddy, Branson Turner, if he's listening, I have to say it's one of the greatest movie experiences I've ever had, because me and the rest of the audience were just sort of discovering as the movie went on, oh, this is a fun movie. Oh, this is a really fun movie. And it just kept building and building and building, and the audience was insane by the end of that screening.
I love your reference to the movie Speed as a quote-unquote sleeper hit, because there is nothing sleepy about this movie, like, at all, beginning to end. Rob has already promised me he's going to tear apart this movie. I will tolerate it. I love this movie. I have a lot to say about it. And I, in particular, want to discuss how initially this movie was pitched as Die Hard on a bus, right? And
pretty
people
much,
see
yeah.
it as Die Hard on the bus. This movie differs from Die Hard in a huge and very, very important way. I'm going to be that jerk and say we will talk about that in a minute. Because first, Roth would like to talk about the production of this movie.
Yes. The movie started as an idea from Graham Yost, who people will eventually know as the creator of Justified. But at the...
that's such a good show.
And it's a great show. And it came from the idea of the 1985 movie Runaway Train. Let's see, it starred John Voight, Eric Roberts, and featured a very young Danny Trejo. But it was based on a story idea by Akira Kurosawa, something you wouldn't expect. Yost loved the idea and he went, but it doesn't make sense. It would be cooler if there was a bomb on the train. And then he went, but what if it was on a bus and the bus couldn't slow down? He's like, what if it couldn't go under 20 miles an hour? And then a friend of his said, it'd be cooler if it was 50 miles an hour. And then he pitched it originally as with the title Minimum Speed. But people went, you don't want the word minimum in a title.
Mm-mm.
So it
Hello, Maximum Overdrive.
So it became Speed. And the project was taken around, pitched to a few places. It was pitched to John McTiernan, who actually recommended that his cinematographer, who he knew who he wanted to become a director, get on the project. This is rare that cinematographers become directors, but I will say that Jan de Bont, at this point, was the best action cinematographer in the industry. He had done Die Hard, he had done Hunt for Red October, he had done Black Rain, he had done Basic Instinct, he did some of the best-looking movies at the time, and in fact, J.J. Abrams, the lens flare style that everyone makes fun of, is something he specifically co-opted off of Jan de Bont's look in the first Die Hard and The Hunt for Red October.
I mean, when they open the vault in Die Hard, there are so many amazing lens flare shots of Hans's face. Yeah, no, you're totally right.
And so he was the man who created that visceral style. And it's very much in effect in this movie, because this movie looks way more expensive than it was. Because amazing to think of a movie where half of it is a chase. Half of it is outdoors. Mm-hmm. There's dozens of stunts. There's just, it's not nonstop action, but it's nonstop movement in the movie.
Very true. Very true.
And for the project, they originally thought about Stephen Baldwin as the lead, to which we will add to the sort of, okay, yeah, great. And thankfully...
Actually, more like, okay, boomer. Look, I don't want to start a beef with the Baldwins, you know, whatever. Obviously, Sandra Bullock is the winner of this movie. She won everyone's heart. They went on to base the rest of the Speed franchise around her. But it's hard to imagine somebody other than Keanu as a star, because he's just the perfect straight man. Again, which none of us expected after what we'd seen him in up to this point. He ended up being such a great straight man action hero that everyone else can be colorful and interesting around. And he still gets plenty of good lines too.
And that's the key to it for me, is that now we know and now we love Keanu and we respect him for his intelligence and how he has very wisely sort of pushed the dramatic acting off onto other actors in his movies, and he gets to do the action and the stoic hero.
But that started somewhere, and I think it started here.
Because he had a lot of effect on his character, and he had rewrites play into what he had finally realized were his strengths. He was a man that clearly from the beginning knew what people were saying about him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he reworked his character instead of being a cocky asshole to be the sort of well-meaning, not super intelligent, but instinctive character?
I don't think that's fair. I think he's very... First of all, I can't think of an instance in the movie that says that he's not intelligent. And second of all, he uses his intuition really, really well. Like when he sees the airport sign and thinks there's going to be a circular drive at the airport, we should take the bus to the airport. So I don't...
And that's his arc for them. Well, I'm getting to a point here. That's his arc for the movie.
But even because in the beginning, when they're in the elevator scene, you can see that he's thinking like 3, 4, 5, 6 steps ahead, looking at everything, trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together. I'm just saying, I don't think his character is not smart.
He is smart. The movie frames it, though, where both his mentor and the bad guy are constantly telling him he's stupid. And the beauty of this is, and they do the same thing in The Matrix, which is they intentionally make us underestimate his intelligence as a character. And that's his arc for the movie. And that's based on our perception of him at the time. And that's how he turned it, is he made people think he was less intelligent than he was.
That's fair. But personally, I disagree. I think that most of his arc in the story is that he doesn't feel emotionally invested in his work. And again, this is part of the bigger point that I'm going to make, that initially he's the cop who can be detached and doing his job. And through this movie, he really becomes part of this group, of this team, of this community, becomes connected to them. And that is what changes him as a character. But again, we can get into that in a minute.
I actually think that's the other key element of it. But I mean, I remember very particularly, this is bouncing into the narrative, one of the key points of the story is when Harry, his partner, played by Jeff Daniels, tells him after the first set piece, you know, following your gut is going to get you killed. You have to start, you know, you have to start thinking. And that really is the thesis of what he needs to learn to do in the story, because his big turning point in the story is when he starts slowing down, not jumping into a situation and processing it and outsmarting the bad guy.
Ironic for a movie called Speed. Do you want to talk about the story? I think we should talk about the story first and then get into characters and big things. Okay. Do you want to summarize this movie or should I?
Well, you pretty much said it pretty well as the bus that couldn't slow down.
Bus from Speed.
This is a movie with no fat. And it's very simply a mad terrorist bomber played by Dennis Hopper, who is unnamed for the first half of the movie, has set up a bomb inside of an elevator in an LA skyrise. And then Jack and Harry, two SWAT team members from the bomb disposal unit, played by Keanu and Jeff Daniels, come in and manage to thwart his plan, seemingly killing him in the process.
Yeah, I mean, something blows up, they think it's him. They have a big celebration, they get awards, because Jack shoots Harry in the leg. It's a whole part of the plot. Anyway, but I just want to give you the big overview, because we had a lot to say. So they get awards for their bravery and saving all these people in the elevator. They have a big party next day, they're super hungover, and yet Jack is in the right place at the right time and sees a bus blow up just after having talked to the driver. Payphone, please, I really hope you all know what payphones are. If you don't, just Google it. So a payphone nearby starts ringing, and Jack answers it. It's the bomber, he's still alive, and he tells him that there's a bomb on another bus. It's going to explode if it goes under 50 miles an hour. But it's like he sort of sets it up so that there's the possibility that Jack can save these people. So Jack obviously like goes off, you know, we see the bus, we see Sandra Bullock like running and screaming to try to get on the bus, and bus takes off. Long story short, Jack chases the bus, gets on the bus, tells everybody what's going on, everybody freaks out, and then it becomes a race against time to A, try to catch the bomber, B, try to find a way to get the people off the bus, even though he says he will blow it up if anyone tries to leave, and see. Actually, no, those are the two
that's
big things,
it.
Right?
That's pretty much it.
It's like, we got to stop the bomber, and we got to get people off the bus, but the bus is going real fast. And then, you know, hilarity ensues.
And that simplicity is what makes it, in my opinion, one of the greatest dumb action movies ever made.
It's interesting. I felt a lot when I watched Run Lola Run years later, the same thing, where it's just non-fucking-stop. You know, it's the movie that you go into and you're like, oh, I'm a little tired. You are awake for the whole fucking thing. It is. I mean, it's true. Edge of your seat in entertainment.
And it's, in my opinion, the best Die Hard imitator, because like you said, it's not exactly Die Hard, though it takes some of the core fundamentals of Die Hard and transposes it into a different style narrative, because Die Hard is always a siege narrative, whereas this is a chase narrative, but what's really clever in it is how the first act is basically the diehard part of it, which is you're in a big, tall skyscraper, you're dealing with elevator shafts and logic games of dealing with stuff. The only difference is you're not dealing with a whole bunch of terrorists, but it is the person trying to get money and our heroes thwarting them.
Okay, so three things I want to discuss before I forget them. I'm probably going to forget them all. Okay, first of all, When we rewatched this movie today, it was the first time in I can't remember how long that I watched the first part of it. I cannot watch the first part of this movie. It freaks me out too much. The elevator scene is genuinely terrifying. And I say that because at my first job out of college, I was working at then the publishing company Houghton Mifflin. And one day over lunch, it was in Boston, some of my coworkers and I went to the Prudential, which is this very, very, very tall building. We took the elevator all the way to the top. Great view. Took the elevator all the way to the bottom. Walked back to our building, got in the elevator, and it stopped. And it's freaky. It was so freaky because it was moving and then stop all of a sudden. And then the silence, and then the lights went out, and then the alarm started. I have very rarely been that terrified in my entire life. We hadn't even left the first floor. I mean, we were maybe like 6 inches off the ground. And thank God, you know, everything came back really, really quickly. But I gotta admit, that was all I could think of in that moment. And it was so fucking terrifying. I'm a big believer in stairs, ladies and gentlemen. Big believer in stairs.
What's beautiful about that sequence is that it deals with, and actually the whole movie deals with it, is that a lot of the danger deals with something that's relatable. Like an elevator, a bus, a subway train. There's no element of it we haven't experienced, and it's like the worst case scenario for things we encounter in a urban day-to-day experience. And what's so perfect, this is one of the best first acts of an action movie ever.
This is true. I mean, it gets you started. We could talk all day about, is this movie Die Hard? Is this movie not Die Hard? How do they compare or contrast? That's fine. But John McClane is part of what made him such an interesting character is that he doesn't want to be there. Like, he gets pulled into this action kind of against his will. He's bewildered most of the movie. Jack knows what he's doing. Jack was already, I mean, first of all, it's his job. He is an LA cop. He does get pulled into it, but he was also invested in it from scene one during the elevator scene, you know? So but by the time he's on the bus, he wants to be there. It's not like he's just stuck there at a holiday party and has to, you know, shoot his way out and try to save somebody. He chooses to be part of this action. And so I think that sort of sets up a very different dynamic.
And it's also he's part of a team. They make it very clear that him and Harry are a duo that work very well together.
Yeah.
And the story is about taking away all of his support system, so he has to be acting on his own by the end. So it's sort of the exact opposite in this sense. And what I love about him as a character is he's a pure actor. And he always is, okay, there's something wrong with the elevator, so I'm going to get a crane on it. Or, wait a minute, the bad guy has to be here, so we go track down where the bad guy is. And each action scene plays off of clean, simple logic that's not hard to follow. Mm-hmm. So his choices come off as rather intuitive and intelligent. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that you get him encountering the bad guy, and that first showdown between them is so good.
Yeah.
Where they have to go and they chase him into his elevator, and then he holds Harry hostage. And it's, considering you're going to spend the whole movie without the bad guy and the good guy in the same scene together, it just sets up a wonderful dynamic between him and Dennis Hopper, who is one of the most hateable bad guys, because he's such an arrogant, resentful, passive-aggressive, just constantly needling our characters that you're really eager to see this guy taken out fairly early on.
But he also has that air of being a genuine threat. He's not just a cartoonish villain. He acts cartoonish in a lot of ways, but he's a very, very real threat, and you know that. I'm going to go ahead and jump into the big point that I want to make about this movie, which I realized today. And I've seen this movie so many times, and today, looking at it just from a bigger perspective, this movie has the philosophy that selfishness is punished. The first example that I can think of is when Helen, also known as, first of all, the honest trailers for Speed is fantastic. They refer to her as, I doubt your commitment to Sparkle Motion. So Helen / the Sparkle Motion woman, she selfishly tries to leave the bus, even though they've already been told that everyone will die if anyone other than the driver leaves the bus. So she gets punished for her selfish action. At the very beginning, there's one woman in the elevator who refuses to leave because she's scared. Both she and Helen are sort of older women, and initially watching this, I thought, you know, is this movie just like trying to punish older women? Is it trying to like just sort of say something? And then I realized, no, they're treated very differently. The woman on the elevator is afraid, and they encourage her and they yell at her, and she gets off the elevator. But Helen is being selfish, and she gets punished for that. And I think that this is a really intriguing comparison, especially to more modern action films where being like a lone wolf or going against the system gets rewarded, as opposed to working together and making sacrifices to keep the community safe. And you see this throughout Speed. You see it when the cops commandeer the TV cameras at the airport and tell them that they have to stop filming. And you can hear a reporter saying, yeah, sure. And even at the end, when Annie can't get out of the handcuffs and Jack chooses to stay with her and she just puts her handcuffed arms around him, which first of all, so sweet. Second of all, again, we can't talk about how realistic this movie is. But throughout this film, the characters consciously make choices for their mini community, for their society, and that is what helps them survive. And again, like, I just love seeing this in an action movie because it's not something you see a lot of.
And that's actually what cooperation was the word that popped in my head when I was watching
Shut up. We came to the same point.
Look, cooperation is a theme in the movie.
He's literally written it in all caps. And see, I love that we both came up with this, but I also kind of hate you. But I love you, but I hate you.
Well, and it's because the cops are always working at the peak of their abilities. It's a very interesting movie in that it's one of the last pre-internet, sort of everyone has a cell phone type of movies.
Yeah, so and, like, we were talking about how when they figure out that part of the freeway is missing, it's totally plausible because it's on the map. So why wouldn't it be there? But, you know, I guess they didn't.
They weren't expecting the bus having to jump over the whole, you know, contingency plan that everyone has in LA planning.
You assume the map is correct.
And all the cops, no one acts stupid in terms of the cops. Everyone's trying to do their best to solve the situation.
Cooperatively.
And even in the bus, there's a strong sense of cooperativeness. Because even Beth Grant's character, Helen, you understand why she would do it.
Oh, fuck yeah.
And so you don't go, oh, what a horrible person. You go, what a horrible situation. Instinctively, I might do that too. So I never hate her the way they would do it in another movie.
No, I don't think that you hate her, but you're just, she made me afraid. Because panic is such a strong emotion, and it's something that we can all relate to, and it's something that can instantly wedge us apart.
When you look at the whole bus, which is clearly a microcosm of LA, the only thing it really doesn't have on there I looked at was kids and homeless people. Besides that,
super wealthy people.
Well, super wealthy people never ride the bus in
LA. No, but I'm just saying, if you're talking about like a microcosm of LA and society, you know, that part is absent. So
they have characters like blow up at each other briefly, but they all come to consensus fairly quickly of, you know, mm-hmm. we're all in this together.
Yep.
And so when you have characters like Sam, the bus driver, who's always doing his best to protect everyone on the bus, even when he's injured, mm-hmm. Or Ortiz, Gigantor, as he's referred to, he's always helping out Jack. Mm-hmm. And when Alan Ruck's character almost dies when he's falling off of the cart, when they're trying to get off the bus, he pulls him up and he saves him and they hug each other.
Yeah.
And so the thing that really, man, I'm getting emotional thinking about it, is that there's that moment where Jack, in the second half of the movie, has to get off the bus to go talk with the captain and figure out the new plan. And
there's a cut into the second point I want to make, but keep going.
And there's a clear emotion that they don't want him to leave. They've built a relationship with him, and he now feels a responsibility for everyone on the bus. And he's telling them, I'll be back. There's like so much more emotion there, and I realized that's what other movies, smart or dumb in terms of action movies, don't nail, which is that, oh, there's a connection between these characters, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that we care about these characters.
Exactly. Every time that one vehicle with people pulls away from another vehicle, I got emotional. Especially the first time when the police trailer pulls away from the bus right before the bus jumps the huge gap in the highway. And it happens again later when Jack gets onto the police trailer, you know, to go under the bus, and you see all the bus passengers stare at him as they drive away. And even when, you know, all the passengers finally get on the airport transit vehicle and they pull away from Jack and Annie. I mean, these shots that show like that the community recognizes that they're being torn apart and their deep worry for one another. And, you know, it's so powerful. And rewatching this, I was reminded of the scene of all things, go with me on this, of the scene in the movie Twister, where the red truck has to keep going. I forget exactly what they're doing, but I remember the emotion very strongly that all the other cars have to pull away because that's the only vehicle that's like going into the tornado. And that totally makes sense because Jan Dubont is the director of both movies. I love that. I love that you believe how much these people have had to connect with each other and how invested they are in one another's survival. And it comes through so beautifully. There are a lot of films that force it, but man, I mean, I know a lot of it is based on the musical cues and just the motion of the filming, but it's almost poetic. I love it. It's very moving for me.
It's the phrase that came to mind was, wow, this may be the best Michael Bay action movie I've ever seen.
Oh no.
No, but I have a big thing behind this, and I gotta unpack this, is that this movie came out at a very particular period in terms of action films. And a lot of current action directors of this day came out within the 3 to 4 years around this point. Michael Bay's first action movie was the very next year. And both him and The Bond are very similar in that they're using the same visual language, meaning they're referencing Cameron, they're referencing Spielberg, they're referencing George Miller, they're referencing McTiernan. And they both use very similar principles on how they're filming. The difference is Jan de Bont doesn't supercut his scenes. Jan de Bont keeps his eye on the emotion of the characters. But they're all built off of the same sort of silly action, whatever gets you going principle. The only difference is de Bont is always keyed into how the characters are feeling here. Which is why I care. That's why the Bond wasn't imitating Michael Bay, but they were using the same playbook, the same tool set, with much different results, in my opinion.
Well, Bay's movies tend to rely a lot more on humor. I mean, obviously, juvenile humor. Kind of on that point, Rob, one of the things I noticed was how many times they pan into Harry's face after the elevator and during the bus plot. Like, when Harry first answers the phone and he's slumped over his desk. He's so hungover. And Jack calls him and he's like, this is better. You better not be calling in sick because I dragged my ass to the office. And Jack just says, Harry, he's alive. And Harry says, what? As the camera pans in on him. And it keeps doing that. And Roth pointed out that part of the reason that that choice was made was because on the bus, there's so much movement. Things are constantly moving. And so to have a similar engaging effect with a character who's just sitting at a desk, the pan-in makes a lot of sense. And what I also noticed this time was, as the bus part of the plot keeps going, Harry gets more, he starts off at his desk, hungover, and then he just keeps moving. He moves more and more and more. He gets up and is running around the office at maps and stuff, and then, you know, eventually goes out on the mission to Dennis Hopper's character's house, and we all know how that ends. I fucking hate that.
It makes no sense.
It doesn't. It really doesn't. It goes against everything in the action movie playbook. Like, yes, an important character is supposed to die, but not like, you know, the main character's best friend. I mean, or maybe that is... No, that happens
because it's meant to be the mentor dies so that the hero, it's you know, Obi-Wan dies, Gandalf dies.
I can still hate it.
It's because it's not justified, because really Harry always acts intelligently the entire movie.
He has a wife. We never meet her. For some reason, she's not at the ceremony with the awards, which is super weird. But yeah, Harry does not deserve to die in this movie. I'm very, very annoyed about that. Yeah.
You know what I would have... There's several things to say about that. One is that I'm in total agreement with you. It makes no sense. It'd be another thing if someone else did something stupid so that Harry dies protecting the other person from the mistake they made or something.
Yeah.
Or Howard maybe planted a bomb at the office instead.
Or that Jack told him, like, oh, go to this house and get it done. And then it turns out to be the wrong call because he was thinking too rashly. I hate it.
Yeah, something like that.
Because
Harry is like one of the best sidekick partners ever, because Jeff Daniels.
Okay, there's a lot to say about like the storyline and details in the movie, but I'm gonna just sort of stop the car, take a turn. We're talking about the characters for a minute, starting with Jeff Daniels. Harry.
I love Harry. I love Harry so much. Jeff Daniels, he's the guy that as a kid I was like, I wish he was my dad. Meaning back in the day.
Slightly different feeling.
Well, I wonder why. But the thing is, he has so much warmth and so much relatability. He's always had, even nowadays. He's such a phenomenal actor. And he is one of the best reactors in the business. He has a good way of making everyone around him look really good, too.
I'm going to be blunt. I'm having trouble thinking immediately about another movie that I watched a whole lot that he was in. I admit, I've seen Dumb and Dumber a couple of times, but I don't like that movie.
Same year.
So weird. But yeah, I love Jeff Daniels in Speed so much. I'm looking at my notes right now, and I wrote, Jeff Daniels was so weirdly hot in this movie. So, yeah, I mean, Keanu is very, very sexy. It's hard to deny that. He's gorgeous. He's fantastically hot in this movie. But what I remember is finding Jeff Daniels' sort of tired puppy dog face and perpetual exhaustion just appealing because it felt real. It's like, you know, this could be a dude that you know where he's just really tired or hungover, but he can still have a good one-liner once in a while. And he's, you know, self-sacrificing to shoot the hostage thing in the leg. Basically, in my notes, I summed him up as, I would have gone home with him after a party if Keanu wasn't there. So,
and
that's how I feel about that character.
And I think he's essential to the first act, because what happens is for the first 30 minutes, mm-hmm. he is our relatable emotional lens in a narrative, like the person who gives us reality. But then he does the baton pass over to Sandra mm-hmm. Bullock. Once he's physically out of the action, yeah. Sandra is now our baseline for how to relate to the narrative.
But there's such an action movie cliche of the cop that's going to die, where you see it set up. It's become, it was even a cliche in The Simpsons, you know, the Mandel's hot. Like, everyone knows that they die like the day before retirement, right? I did not see Harry's death coming. I did not. I remember being in the theater and just being shocked and horrified. Like, because, how? Why?
Because we had set up, when you're and Jeff Daniels in the credits, you're mm-hmm. thinking, oh, okay, he's not going to be in the movie long. So you think he's going to die in the elevator action sequence when you first see the movie.
Oh, I didn't think he was going to die.
Oh, I thought he was. Oh, I was so waiting for him to be the... See, I thought he was going to be the reason that Keanu Reeves was going to have to take down Dennis Hopper because he lost his partner, because it's such a cliche. Mm. So by getting him shot by Keanu was such a great subversion of the trope at the time. And I remember the audience had a great reaction to that too. Mm. And so you think, oh, he's safe. He's safe now as an audience member, only to bring him back in the action and take him out.
Mm. Now I'm sad.
You're supposed to feel sad. It's the hero's lowest moment. I also like the fact that the movie has as the boss, Joe Morton, playing Mac. And it's one of the few movies where he plays an authority figure who isn't killed or maimed or something in a movie, which was a running joke for me through the 90s.
Yeah, when we were rewatching this a while ago, I remember suddenly thinking, holy shit, it's Miles Dyson from Terminator 2. Oh, I'm so glad he doesn't blow up in this.
And I also like how the movie treats him like dad. Because, for instance, when Keanu and Sandra Bullock are together after the bus, they're off the bus and they meet Mac for the first time, like all face-to-face, same scene. It's like son showing his new girlfriend to dad.
I felt it was more like meeting Carl Winslow in Die Hard. That had more of that kind of vibe for me.
Now we got to talk about the most important character of the movie, of course.
Fucking hell. It's amazing to be able to look back and say, this is when a star was born. This was when a celebrity was launched. And I say that as somebody who... There are some actors I love, some actresses I love, and that's fine. But, man, I just thought Sandra Bullock was the most darling, adorable, wonderful actress in the world after this movie. She was just... She was charming in a way that didn't feel forced down your throat. I don't watch a lot of romantic comedies because I can't fucking stand most of them. I don't like just having my nose rubbed in how adorkable someone is and they're like, oh, crazy life. No. The thing about Sandra Bullock's character, Annie, is she's a hot mess, but she's a hot mess in a way that, like, you kind of get. I mean, the first time you meet her, she's running down the street screaming at the bus driver, stop the bus, stop the bus, which Ralph has pointed out that out of all of the unrealistic things in this movie, the bus driver stopping for someone may be one of the least realistic parts.
Well, Jeanine Garofalo made a whole comedy routine up over it.
So, yeah. So Annie starts off as a hot mess, but she's still sweet. You know, she knows people on the bus. She says hi. She says hi. She knows a bus driver. And she's got that great line about, like, you are a good man, and one day people are going to write songs about you. So it's clear that, you know, she's a hot mess, but she's charismatic and not in an annoying way. And then when Alan Ruck, oh my God, when he like starts, I don't want to say hitting on her, but he's just like,
he's hitting on her.
He can't take a hint that she's not interested. So he keeps talking to her and she has to do what every most people I know who identify as female have been through, which is trying to politely get out of it. And so you can see her just rolling her eyes and she just puts her own gum in her hand. She's like, oh, there's gum on my chair and sits somewhere else. And it's sassy without being cartoonish.
She's not trying to be mean.
No, exactly.
And that's
yeah.
what makes you like her more.
Yeah.
She is a romantic comedy character in an action movie. That's how she operates as a character.
But she's also kind of she's a flawed heroine, mm-hmm. which you don't see a lot of in mainstream romantic comedies. She had her license taken away because she was speeding, which again, because it's a very funny joke in the movie, she's not super sweet under pressure. Like at one point when they're trying to get Keanu Jack under the bus, and Ortiz is telling her, like, oh, keep it steady. And she's like, oh, thank you so much, Ortiz. Like, I didn't know that. You know, she's not super gracious. She even takes the blame for when Dennis Hopper kidnaps her at the end. And she tells Jack, like, I'm sorry. Like, it's your fault, girl. It's not your fucking fault.
But she goes through very real emotions. Meaning, yes. Like, usually the female lead is really there to build up the male lead.
Right.
And she's clearly there within her own narrative. And mm-hmm. what I like is, like, how she feels guilty after Helen dies. And she was just grateful that she was alive.
Yes, and she even admits that. She's like, and I felt, what was it? She's like, and I realized that I was still here and I feel so bad about that. Yeah. I love her because she's quirky and charming, but not in an unrealistic way. It's a way that feels familiar. It could be you. It could be your friend. It could be, she's someone you can both want to be and potentially become. You know, but she's not perfect. Not everything about her is perfect. She's delightfully human.
And she's doing most of her performance while steering a wheel.
Yes.
She's sitting down.
And she's got, first of all, she's got some of the best lines in the movie. I made notes of some of my favorite lines. Alan Ruck, who, again, like the first time that I'd seen him since Ferris Bueller, I was like, holy shit, Cameron's in this movie. He gets most of the great lines, like when Keanu is looking under the bus and goes, fuck me. And he relays through the mic, oh, darn. And then later, when they get to the airport, and he's like, we're at the airport. And Ortiz goes, so? And he goes, I've already been to the airport. But Sandra Bullock has some of the best moments, like near the end, again, when Ortiz is like asking her a question, and then she looks at him, and she says, get your ass behind that yellow line. And when they're about to make the really, really hard turn, and she turns the turn signal on, everyone cracked the fuck up. And they should, because it's funny. It's such a small detail, but it's a great one. There's a really, I think, underappreciated comedy that came out a couple of years ago called The Spy Who Dumped Me. I highly recommend seeing it. It's very funny. It's a delightful representation of honest modern-day female friendships. And it's filthy, but it's funny as anything. And there's a moment when they're speeding through Prague and the bad guys are chasing them. And one of them puts on the turn signal and the other's like, what the fuck are you doing? You're telling them where we're going. She's like, I'm just being a good driver. Yeah, I love that. Anyway, I'm here for Sandra Bullock in this movie. She's delightful. She's wonderful. I have nothing bad to say about her. I love her fashion choices. Oh my God. The flower dress, the big boots with the socks, the barrettes, so 90s, so perfect. And her eyebrows. I have such Sandra Bullock and Jack eyebrow envy in this movie. In fact, real quick, I would like to just send a shout out to some of the fantastic fashion choices in this movie. Rob is looking at me like he has something to say. I know he agrees with me on all of these. First of all, the retro lady on the bus with her glasses. You know who I'm talking about. Love those glasses. I had some like that in sunglass form for years. Now I have some in actual glasses form. The only thing I don't love is her frumpy hair, but whatever. You know, it's a good look. I'm here for it. I love the dude with the kind of like cranky dude with the color me bad, giant mushroom hair. Here for it. I love the older black couple who look like they're going to church. I love their clothing. You know what? Everyone on the bus, I think, has made some very good fashion choices. Some of them are kind of like specifically mid-90s, but I love it. I love it. Everyone on the bus
Black
is good.
Black lady in power suits, one of
yes.
my personal favorites.
Yes, here for the good fashion choices.
Well, I just wanted to rewind to Sandra real quick. She is such a strong character, actually, to go back to who they almost cast. First, it was supposed to be Halle Berry as this really serious medic. So it was, I get the feeling it was more of a hard tone to the character. Mm-hmm. Then they went, okay, no, let's do more comedy and make Ellen DeGeneres. And then it sort of, what they did that I thought was smart was split the difference between the two concepts, which is where Sandra Bullock fit in. And she had been in some movies beforehand. She was just in Demolition Man, like a little bit under a year before that. So,
fun fact, if you read Brave New World in high school, there are a ton of Brave New World references in Demolition Man. Specifically, Sandra Bullock's character is named Lenina Huxley. I'm sorry, as a book nerd, I was psyched about that when I saw it in the theater. Please continue.
And so she was this actress that they were trying to figure her out. They were like, maybe she's the next Julia Roberts, because that was everyone's sort of question on lips for years after Pretty Woman. They knew she was good, but they just hadn't figured her out yet. So she was really an interesting choice here, because these movies take enough time to make. It's not like they saw Demolition Man and went, oh, she's right for the role. No, yeah. They just sort of like the personality combo. And I think that's what's really smart about the casting all through the movie is they're good at getting character chemistries really right.
True.
So that you like the group of characters acting together.
Because now I'm thinking about her character in Speed versus, for example, her character in Miss Congeniality, which, full disclosure, not one of my favorite movies, by a long shot. In Miss Congeniality, her character is just, she's a cartoon. She's a caricature. She's like goofy. She's got a goofy laugh. She can't keep a man. Doesn't like lady clothes. It's just such broad, dumb comedy. And she doesn't feel like a real person at any moment. And no men take her seriously. In Speed, she totally feels like a real person who has to deal just with everyday shit every day. And so then when she gets thrust into an extraordinary situation, she's down for it. As opposed to, you know, a cartoon who gets thrust into an extraordinary situation and flails all over the place. I wish that there were more characters like Annie in film today, in action movies, in romantic comedies, in fucking anything. I would love to see more charming people who aren't perfect and can react to situations in ways that are interesting and funny, even though at the same time you're kind of like, yeah, I would totally do that. I love it. I love it, and I wish there was more of it.
And I sort of identified for me why I stick with the movie in the last act, which is clearly the weakest part of it. And it's because you care about her. You care about what happens to her.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, no one's leaving that theater once if she's in danger. Absolutely not.
And I even love the last bit between her and Keanu, their little thing about, you know, relationships.
That don't last when they're based on being in extraordinary situations. She's like, okay, well, we'll just have to base it on sex then. And even then, like, being raised in a super Catholic household and thinking, oh, sex before marriage is wrong. Like, part of me was like, okay, I get it. No, yeah, no, these two should totally go bone it out. I get it.
And the movie ends with the two of them kissing, not with, like, a bunch of cop cars there or anything.
It ends just like Twister.
Yeah, it's it's over.
Kind of music. There's that sort of, like, dramatic, almost sad, like, swelling of the orchestra. And then into the heavy metal song. Woohoo! I kind of wanted to do this as a Twister double episode, but we just realized we had so much to say about Speed that we decided to just go ahead and film this. But, so we've talked a lot about the characters. I have notes about pretty much just specific things that happened in the movie that I want to tell to a captive audience. Are you cool with that?
Go ahead.
Okay. So the first thing I wanted to ask is a sort of would you rather. Keanu basically commandeers the car, the very nice, was it a BMW convertible, a Merc convertible? A fancy convertible with the license plate Toon Man as the T-U-N-E-M-A-N as the driver is like, I paid a lot for this car, dude. Be careful with it. And Keanu is trying to get onto the bus. He opens the driver's side door, slams on the car's brakes, and then the bus knocks the door off. And Ralph and I were talking about the logistics of it. Like, well, what if the car spun around? Like, he's really, really counting on this being able to knock the door off the car. And then after that, you know, obviously the man is very, very upset because this is his car, is his pride and joy. And then when Keanu has his giant brick of a cell phone and he's like, hey, can I keep this? And the guy's like, take the phone. You know, because his car's destroyed. He doesn't care. But today, what would be worse? Having the driver's side door of your car knocked off or having someone steal your phone? And I got to admit, I like my car. I would feel far more frustrated by my phone because that's shit that's hard to set up. That's complicated. You know, I'm not trying to invite fate here, but I'd way rather have someone say like, oh, I knocked the door off your car than, oh, I destroyed your phone.
Because post 2008 or whenever you got your first smartphone, the amount of time it took to set up a phone with your emails, with your contacts, with your all of your subscriptions and logins and everything.
Yeah.
That's days of work.
Now, I'm not saying I want either to happen. Please, God, universe, don't knock my car door off. Don't let anything happen to my phone. I'm just saying that it's kind of funny that in, you know, retrospect, like, man, it's just sad how much we rely on our phones, how much we have to rely on our phones.
You were talking about in particular, like, the illogical nature of so many things in the movie.
I mean, but we'll be here all day.
No, but I don't want to get into it much. Mm-hmm. But I just want to say there's so much stuff they don't discuss. What's Mr. Payne's plan for getting the money and this and that? It's kind of like there's so many holes in it. But it doesn't matter, A, because of the momentum of the movie. B, because the central conceit is so absurd in any major metropolitan city that the bus would go over 50 and then go under 50 in less than a minute, and then it would blow. Like, that's the length of the movie would be. Mm-hmm. And that's the joke to anyone who's ever lived in LA, that it's just such an absurd concept that there's never this point where you take the movie seriously.
Well, I mean, I lived in Boston for 6 years, and I don't remember being on a bus that was going over 30 miles an hour. But I didn't use a commuter bus. I just, you know, used one of the city buses. And it's constant stopping and starting.
Exactly.
So,
and I think because of that, you engage the absurdity at a particular level that you never hold it against it. I remember even when the movie came out, anyone who put an argument up against the movie about how stupid it was, no one put in the time to really argue it, because like, seriously, are you going to go there? It's not.
We're not here for the plausibility.
There is another hero of this movie besides the phenomenal lead actors, the great cast in general, chemistry, and the phenomenal direction by Jan de Bont, and it is really the uncredited rewrite screenwriter on the project, Joss Whedon. And this was early in his career, before Buffy, before even his Oscar nomination for the first Toy Story script a year later. But he was like the hot rewriter of the mid-90s. And he pretty much wrote all of the dialogue of the entire movie. And what is so key to that, from everything I've heard on and read about the back behind the scenes, is that he added a lot of the humanity to the story. Mm-hmm. He took like Alan Ruck's character, and he was supposed to be asshole lawyer who dies, and turned him into hapless tourist.
Yeah.
Everyone has a little bit of humanity. Ortiz has mm-hmm. humanity.
Oh, yeah.
Sam has humanity. Mm-hmm. You like the characters.
There's no one that you look at and you think, I can't wait for that person to die. You know, again, even Dennis Hopper's, I refer to everybody else by their character name, Howard Payne. Even Howard Payne, like, he's so disturbing, you know, but he also seems like just such a big force.
And he has that completely great line.
Which one?
Poor people.
Oh, yeah. He's when he gets all the money and wait, what does Jack call him?
You're crazy.
Oh, he's like, poor people are crazy, Jack. I'm eccentric.
And in fact, one thing I sort of realized during this version of the screening is that when Harry is doing pop quiz hotshot to Jack, he's really trying to educate him the whole movie. He's playing mentor to him. He is trying to teach him. Yeah, he is.
I disagree. I feel like he's playing off of the scene in the elevator where he's listening in on Harry and Jack quizzing each other. And he's just sort of, he's jealous of their relationship and how they have this career that ultimately literally hurt him. And he sees that they're enjoying each other's company, and that even in this situation of incredible duress, they're literally standing on top of dynamite and C4, and yet they're still able to sort of casually quiz each other.
Yes.
And I feel
you're confusing the names, though. I'm saying Harry, Jeff mm-hmm. Daniels, mm-hmm. is trying to teach Jack Keanu.
And then
Howard, you're absolutely right, yeah. though. He is totally jealous.
Yeah.
That's why he keeps pulling it back up. Mm-hmm. And that's why he keeps needling him, because he's the, you can't be this positive about the job.
Yeah.
He resents that joy he has towards the job.
I kind of want to go on this whole tangent about how Howard Payne and Harry are two sides of the same coin.
I think they absolutely are, though.
Okay, we said that then. Then point made.
What I love about it is it's clear that it has that type of very clean dramatic structure. I associate more with Whedon than, say, Jost, if you compare their scripts, because it has a Peril of Pauline type of structure where the line of tension is always kept going. Mm-hmm. There's never a scene where things are good that isn't countered with a scene that things are bad. Like, even when they get the award ceremony, mm-hmm. they end it with showing Howard Payne watching it on TV, so you know he's still alive.
I think part of what makes him such a compelling villain is that he too has suffered. He lost his hearing. He lost most of the use of one of his hands while he was a cop, and he feels that he was treated unfairly. So he's not just like some diabolical villain who just, you know, gets off on being awful or wants to create anarchy. And he's not just a criminal who wants money, though I do want to make a bigger point about that. I am not in any way saying that what happened to him justifies his actions, but I am saying that that makes him a more interesting action movie villain than a lot.
And what I like is that Harry actually addresses Howard Payne's grievances earlier when he's doing one of the when he's talking with him about why are we doing this, and he goes, because you get the get a lousy gold watch mm-hmm. at retirement
and the pension, yeah.
And so we're already addressing it, meaning he is the worst case scenario of someone who doesn't connect with the people around them, that doesn't feel that community that Jack has.
Yep.
And in fact, in the early draft of the script, Harry was supposed to be the villain, but they realized it was too hard to work it into the story. Mm. But that was part of the original sort of genealogy of the script.
What a weird movie that would have. I mean, I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm not saying it hasn't been done, but that would have been a very, very different feeling. Talk about a break in the community.
But I think they were wise enough to go, that doesn't work. So they went to what they have now.
Yeah. Huh. Sorry. I'm like mulling that over. I mean, I'm not going to laugh. The idea of a job that eventually gave you a pension and a cheap gold watch sounds delightful to me. I know. They put their lives on the line. They certainly work hard for it. But like, God, how many jobs these days offer a pension, you know?
So what was I don't know what jobs offer pensions nowadays.
Exactly. I love that there was an era where thieves doing these complicated thievery plans just for money was either thought of as lame or laughable. Like in Die Hard, nobody sees it coming, like that they're just there for money. The villain in Twister is the guy that, God, I'm sorry, I have a lot to say about Twister. The laughable line of, he's just in it for the money, not the science. Even in this movie, Howard Payne at a certain point admits like, yep, I'm just doing this all for money. I mean, and vengeance. But I'm wondering, like, when did this start? Like, did this start with Die Hard? And then when did it become like the regular cliche of the action movie villain where like they want money?
It was a subtextual element of a lot of movies, but Die Hard was the movie that used the trope. We're going to talk about Die Hard in more detail in another episode, by the way, so we're not going to go
shocker.
Too far. But Die Hard covered it up in a clever way, because usually the movie outright says, this is what the villains are after. They don't bait and switch you like that. Most of the Die Hard ripoffs and such would use some variation of the money as the thing. And I think it's an extension of the idea of the 80s corporate greed. I do like that the bumper, the bumper ad on the bus is referencing that, where it says, money isn't everything.
Yeah, right. Was that a real bank ad? Because a lot of publicity in this movie.
No, all of the ads on the bus, I feel, are fake. They had to have been. But that's what art designers are for, are to make stuff like that. One thing I want to say is this movie doesn't date, well, outside of some of the obvious elements we're talking about, but the action is real, the stunt work is real, and most of the impossible things are done through models and not CG. And because of it, it doesn't have that sort of real cheesy fake quality that a lot of movies afterwards would have, where they would have CG explosions and stuff like that. Yeah. All the explosions felt real. There's that amazing bit where a bus blows up in the background right behind Keanu. It's real. It's in the shot. Mm-hmm. And then he runs to the bus and he is like barely 5 feet away from that bus. And then he has to back away because it's too hot. And that final explosion as well is phenomenal. It feels real. And I love this effect they do in the movie where you'll see reflected in windows of vehicles or on the side of the telephone, the pay telephone, you'll see the flames reflecting in it. And it's a beautiful looking movie.
I feel like we were just watching something today where they talked about don't do CGI if you don't have to. Like, do something real because the audience can tell when the actor is reacting to something that's not there. What the fuck were we watching?
We were watching this great video from the video series, Every Frame a Painting.
That's it, yes.
It's pretty much the first one that was really out there that just did this stellar analytical job. And sadly, he's moved on to actually making movies, which isn't sad at all.
Yeah.
But he, to me, is the pioneer of what is all over the internet now.
And that exact episode of Every Frame a Painting is what inspired our conversation about the slow pans on Harry compared to the motion going on behind him. In that YouTube video, the narrator talks about, you know, for example, the scene in Jaws on the ferry and how the camera can stay on the characters because everything behind them is moving and so thus creates tension. Though I would like to send just a real quick shout out. Every Frame a Painting, yeah, Roth is a big fan of that show. I look forward to getting into it. Part of what sort of drove my desire to start a podcast like this is because there are so many great YouTube shows that dig into movies that I love. So if you like us and you want to hear from people who are a little bit smarter than me and have done a little bit more research than me, I mean, Roth certainly brings it. I know I can be a little bit of a goofball, but man, I remain inspired constantly by, for example, Movies with Mikey. I support him on Patreon. He's amazing. And I always feel like I walk away having learned something, and especially with Movies with Mikey. I mean, I just told a friend last night, like, that's almost my religion. I walk away feeling so inspired and so invigorated and hopeful when I don't always feel super hopeful. Oh, I do want to say just real quick, this fun Easter egg. Again, we're going to talk about Die Hard, blah, blah, blah. But if you're a super big action movie fan, so the truck at the beginning of Die Hard that whisks the criminals into the Nakatomi Plaza has a logo on it for a company called Pacific Courier. The filmmakers made it up. In Speed, the plane that blows up with the bus is a cargo plane labeled Pacific Courier. Fun fact. I have told Roth that I want a Pacific Courier t-shirt for my birthday, so I'm just saying that would be amazing. And I think even if you watch the Netflix show, The Movies That Made Us, the episode on Die Hard, somebody is wearing a Pacific Courier hat in it. Pacific Courier is sort of like the super 80s, 90s action movie nerd reference. Just throwing that out there. If you want to use that name in your trivia team, I highly support that.
And I know if I got that wrong, my friend Eric will definitely correct me. So I want to address...
That's such a random name drop. Are you going to say who Eric is or not?
Well, we're going to find out about Eric soon,
okay,
so I don't want
to... Anyway, yeah, spoiler alert.
Yeah, I want to address the only part of the movie I think is even worth criticizing. It's something that stuck with me from when I first saw it, which is, I don't have a solution for it, but when the bus blows up, the movie's over, emotionally speaking. And
disagree.
Okay, that's very interesting to me. So what's your take on that?
My take on that is... It fits in with a lot of other action movies in general, and especially action movies of the time. Once you get the main characters to safety, the film's not over. There's always a really loud, big, flashy epilogue. Again, and the movie that we can't stop talking about apparently happens in Die Hard. You get, you know, everyone down from the roof in theory to safety, and still Crazy Gunman comes after Bruce Willis. Like, there always has to be like one more... I will admit that it's a lot longer in Speed than it is in some movies, but it makes sense because it's too clean an ending. It's too clean an ending, and I feel like, to paraphrase something that Steven Spielberg said about Jaws, so when Steven Spielberg made Jaws, if you're into this movie, I'm sure you know this, he went back and filmed a couple of things, specifically the scene where Hooper is sort of scuba diving around the boat and sees the dead body and freaks out. And he did that because he thought, I've got them this far, I can give them one more scare. They've come with me on the journey this far. I feel like that's what happened in Speed. Like, we were on this journey so far, and it would have been anticlimactic to not have another big set piece. If anything, the elevator scene and the subway scene are bookends to the bus scene. You had to have something as big and powerful and terrifying to sort of as a dessert to this enormous movie.
That is absolutely correct on a structural level. Emotionally, it doesn't play as well. It's both too long and too small, is my opinion, because I hate Howard Payne so much that...
Oh, his death was stupid.
And that's my point. well, that's key to it, because I still care about Sandra through that whole sequence. Mm-hmm. And he's such a great bad guy. It's set up to be a great ending, by the way. It mm-hmm. could be if it sort of moved a little faster through it, but it does not give me that payoff for such a great bad guy that I wanted.
You know what, though? Here's why I like it. Because the movie sticks with the positive side of your emotion. The movie is not about killing off the bad guy and relishing it. The movie is about taking out the bad guy and then focusing on the people that you love. Because again, this is a movie about community. This is a movie about collaboration. And I don't think that it would have been true to its heart to relish in his death sort of the way that Hans Gruber is taken out. You know, because that's powerful, but it's also kind of satisfying because he has this like huge death scene and it's very dramatic. But to do that to Howard Payne, I think, is disingenuous to this emotional journey that we've been on. We want to focus on Annie and we want to focus on Jack because we were so connected to them and we care so much about them that in a way, like, I didn't even though part of me was like, that's it, okay, that's it. But I was back in the game to see what happened to these two people. And shockingly, the stakes had been raised so high that even though, to me, the biggest implausibility is that speeding the subway up is somehow a good idea.
yeah.
But again, like, at this point, I had been on that journey and I was so into it and I cared so much about these characters that I was just like, no, let's do it. Let's fucking do it. He thinks it's a good idea. Sure. Okay. And then when he sits next to her and she puts her little handcuffed hands around his neck and holds him, why am I getting emotional just thinking about this? But to me, that's my argument, that I agree that it's not the best ending for the villain and maybe not one that works as well as it could have. But emotionally, I think it completely makes sense with the bigger context of the movie and reminding us who and what we should care about.
I think, well, you hit it in there that I think is the part that I don't like. He's such a character that they're trying to outmaneuver in an intelligent way. We don't get that satisfying emotional beat where Payne is realizing he's going to lose. He's just furious. And it's just because it's a quick shot of him looking up to see he's about to get hit by the light, and that's it.
But in a way, he dies just like Harry dies. I mean, because Harry just has that moment of like, oh shit.
He doesn't get the oh shit moment. It's so fast that it doesn't register. That Harry moment's wonderful. But that shot is about five times longer than the last shot of Hopper. And I want that sort of arrogance to see, you know, to see the, his failure coming beyond an instinctive, you know, looking up shot.
Maybe that's the most realistic thing about the movie, that we don't always get the ending to the villains that we want, that we don't always get that satisfaction of seeing on their face that they know what they've done wrong.
Fair enough. Plus, I'm taller.
No, man, did Joss Whedon write that? Because that's like, I mean, I laugh at that line, but God damn, it's really bad. And there are some genuinely funny lines in this movie, and that is not.
No. He wrote all of them, but at the same time, Keanu's strengths are not in his line delivery, and we know this.
No, it works though. It's fine. It's fine because, you know, he's trying. It's fine because your tension is so high, and like anything will make you laugh at that point. And it also seems possible. It plays in with that character. It feels right for that character. And I'm here for it.
Well, because I like to think of him as the gentle bro of heroes. Because he's not particularly a deep thinker, but he's a well-meaning guy, and he will put himself on the line as a hero, and that's what makes him charming in the end.
Yeah. He's not a misogynist. He never questions Annie's abilities because she's female. Like, at all. No. It's just like, ma'am, can you do this? Yes. Okay.
And he doesn't even do that for other characters that could be threatening to him in ways. He's always trying to defuse the situation.
Yep, like when the guy gets the gun on the bus, and he's just like, you know, I don't know about your crime, but I'm putting my gun away, and we're just two dudes, and we're just going to figure this out. He is really about defusing the situation, and he does it really well.
By the time he got to The Matrix a few years later, because he would have, between this and Matrix, you would have like Johnny Mnemonic, Chain Reaction, Devil's Advocate. He was still trying to figure himself out. And by the time he got there, he had sort of gone through his full evolution of understanding, oh, the less I talk, the more I react. Because to be very clear, I think he was born to be a silent movie actor. He gives you so much great emotion through his eyes. His movement is beautiful and balletic. He's doing some amazing stunts in this movie.
Yeah, I just want to go on the record as saying I have nothing bad to say about Keanu Reeves. Any criticism that I have of him in this performance is, please just brush it aside. There's this genuine quality to him that I think some people make fun of or make the mistake of thinking that it means he's not a great actor, that he can play only one character. I think it just adds this wonderfully, again, human element to his character portrayals, and I have nothing negative to say about him. I think he's fantastic, and
And I think everyone's caught up to that now.
Yeah.
And I caught up to it by the time The Matrix came out, because I went, oh, I see what your strengths are.
A lot of people made fun of, like when, you know, the whoa line and I know Kung Fu, and those became jokes for a long time.
He knew they were jokes. He did them on purpose. He's not an idiot. He did them on purpose because he knows.
God bless Keanu.
That's the joy of him, is that he's constantly busting his own bubble. He's taking the piss out of himself because he knows that he can't do a whole movie and go, you must take me seriously. He knows that.
He is wiser than all of us.
Yeah, he really is.
I honestly did not think I would have this much to say about Speed. I'm so glad we decided to do this episode. I'm so glad we revisited this movie. I'm so glad that I was willing to look at it from an honest and fresh and critical, but also sort of empathetic perspective of what, you know, how and when, like its place and its time. You know what? I do recommend this movie. I recommend this movie, again, with the caveat that you're going to have a zillion things one after the other to say, like, well, that couldn't happen. That couldn't happen. Well, how would this have happened if that had happened? Let it go. Let it go. This is the action movie meditation for all of us. Like, just let go of the stuff that isn't plausible. Breathe in the stuff that is. Live for community. Let go of plausibility.
It's the namaste of action films. Yes, because I think it may be one of the most positive and optimistic of that genre of action films from like the late 80s through 2000. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of those movies tend to have a really mean streak to them in certain ways, or negativity to them. Mm-hmm. And this is a very light movie.
Or goofiness. Like Twister, as much as I have a big soft spot for that movie, but I'm not going to say it's high quality. I mean, there's a lot of silliness in the script that didn't need to be there. And some of the lines are kind of goofy, and people say things that don't feel realistic and feel very forced. I still have great love for it. As much as I wanted to compare and contrast the two, That one ended up being a lot fluffier and a lot less believable, less mm-hmm. plausible. Also, I mean, as interesting and fun as it was to see a bunch of people chase tornadoes, man, just the gritty day-to-day like survival element of what's going on in Speed is in a lot of ways more interesting and sort of gets at your heart a lot deeper.
Because it takes place over a much tighter time frame.
Mm.
And both movies are using...
I mean, Twister is like in a day and a half.
I know, but...
Oh, Speed's like over a couple hours.
Yeah,
Well, a few days and then a couple hours.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, first act is basically several days. Mm-hmm. And then literally the second two-thirds of the movie...
We're done before noon.
Yeah, pretty much. And so that's one of the things the movie buys you in terms of I won't say plausibility, but acceptability.
Yeah.
Because it holds up for me now.
Mm-hmm.
And I still enjoy the hell out of it now. And it's nice looking back at this movie with this last viewing is now I know why I love it. And I know pretty much I will never not love it.
Yeah.
Because I can't think of that many movies that have this amount of heart in it.
That emphasize community and the idea of working together in a way that doesn't feel forced and doesn't feel cheesy, but that feels organic and that makes you root for all of the good guys.
Completely agree.
Who would have guessed we'd get here about Speed? But so, I'm here for it. I'm here for it. I love this movie. Watch it. Enjoy it.
Pop quiz hotshot. What were we doing at the beginning of June 1994?
We were in the theaters on the edges of our seats and then with the VHS tapes for years and years. Somehow, the movie Speed was one of the many things the kids were watching. Thank you for listening and have a speedy day.
What the Kids Were Watching has been produced and hosted by Sada Ruiz and Rafael Ruiz. Theme music provided by Pete Seibert. For more information on our podcast and to read the companion blog, well, really more of a cartoon sidekick, you can go to whatthekidswerewatching.com. You can also find us on social media. Look for What the Kids Were Watching on Facebook, What the Kids Were Watching on Instagram, and What the Kids Were on Twitter. What the Kids Were Watching. Copyright 2021, RAR Works, LLC.